You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit InsureKidsNow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Hi, I'm Margie, and you're listening to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the weekly podcast where each week I interview a different guest and find out about their 7 Desert Island dishes. The question is, could you narrow down your own choices and settle on the best dish you've ever eaten? Thank you so much for downloading and listening. Don't forget to rate, review, and tell your friends about Desert Island Dishes. I hope you have your snacks at the ready for this one, because there are lots of delicious things in here. Rosie also made me the most incredible white chocolate and rhubarb blondies, and they were so incredibly good. We need to badger her for the recipe. Without further ado, here is today's episode. My guest today is Rosie Birkett. Rosie is a food writer, food stylist, and author. She has written 3 books and has been writing about chefs, restaurants, and food since 2008. Rosie's recipes and food styling have appeared on the cover of BBC Good Food magazine, Olive magazine, and been featured in The Telegraph, Red magazine, Grazia, InStyle, and Guardian Cook, to name literally just a few. Of her brilliant book, A Lot on Her Plate, it was said by none other than Michelle Roux Jr., "In a culinary world full of froths, foams, and smears, this is a book for those that love real food. It's a breath of fresh air and a feast for the eyes, full of mouth-watering recipes to excite the palate and take you to a gastronomic heaven." Welcome, Rosie.
Hello.
Can we just talk about that quote?
Incredibly generous of Michelle to say that.
Do quotes get better than that?
I mean, I couldn't actually believe it when that came through, because I sent him the manuscript for the book, and I knew him from writing, from my job as a restaurant reporter, and I asked him to provide a quote, and didn't think anything would come of it, because you often ask questions and don't expect a response from someone like Michelle Roux Jr. And actually, he phoned me, and it was in the middle of a time when we were trying to buy a house.
Yeah.
And I was getting all of these calls. Like, no one calls me. It's either PPI or my husband. No one else calls me. So whenever I get a call from an unknown number, at that point, I was thinking it was an estate agent.
Oh, yeah.
So I picked up the phone, and I'd previously had these annoying estate agents calling me, and I was like, "Hello?" And then I was like, "Who is this?" Because I didn't recognize the number. And he was like, "Oh, hi, Rosie, it's Michelle." And I was like, "Oh my gosh, hi."
You're so like, sad. "Michelle, who? Speak up."
I was like, "I'm sorry, I thought you were an estate agent." He said, "Oh, I know what you mean. They're not the best." So yeah, that was hilarious. But yeah, really kind of him to say that.
Yeah. And I mean, everyone else, you literally had every amazing person from the food world just raving about your book, which
people
is just
were
incredible.
Really nice. And it was very encouraging, because it was a daunting thing to do, because I sort of at that point was not hugely known for writing recipes, even though I had been doing it for a while. I suppose I was better known for my writing around restaurants and features and interviews with chefs. But I was sort of quietly beavering away on, you know, personal projects like the book and my blog and recipes, which were getting picked up by people and enjoyed. So to get that kind of support from the food world was really incredible and overwhelming, and just it just goes to show what a lovely industry it is to work in.
Yeah.
And how supportive people are.
But also we can't get away from the fact that the book is beautiful and it was all very well-deserved praise. Let's dive straight into talking about the first desert island dish. And that's the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
Okay. Well, it's got to be my mum's roast, Sunday roast.
Oh, wow.
And I know that's a bit of a cop out because it's a broad range of things, but if I had to choose one, it would be roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. But my mum is just an incredible cook. And she, every Sunday of my childhood, cooked, even in the hottest of the heat waves, was cooking these Sunday lunches. And they were a real kind of center point for our family because my granny would come and my uncle Bob, who wasn't actually my uncle, would come, and my auntie Jane, and the whole family would gather, and my dad. And it was just this time where we'd all sit around for hours and hours and eat the most incredible food. And my mum just nailed it absolutely every time. And they were long lunches. They were usually very boozy, not particularly for me and my sister.
Yeah.
Until we were old enough. But yeah, they were just these epic lunches and just really, really happy memories. And some really awful memories of having screaming rows as well.
Obviously. Oh yeah.
Like obviously, every family. Yeah.
It wouldn't be a family occasion without them. No, that's such a nice tradition. Is that something that you've carried on now that you're married?
Sort of. It's very different now. Like I grew up in the countryside in Kent, and you know, we had a big garden, and it was, we were just really lucky to live in this gorgeous location. And I think it was very different then because you know, my parents had us as children, and now our lives are a bit busier, and we don't tend to have massive Sunday lunches. Actually, that's not true. We do. I do have people over to have Sunday lunch. And
yeah,
Jamie and I usually will do a chicken because then we'll kind of live on it for the rest of the week and make stock and stuff like that. So it is something that I love doing. I wouldn't say we do it every Sunday in the same way. But yeah, maybe, you know, maybe when I've got kids, that will be something that we'll want to do.
I think so. I think those kind of traditions evolve throughout your life, don't they? And we sort of may not be doing them now, but as you say, as things change and transition, I think it's something that you come back to.
Yeah, maybe not in the summer though.
No, maybe not in the summer. Maybe a salad in the summer.
Yeah.
We're sitting in your kitchen, which is possibly the most beautiful kitchen I've ever been to. It's amazing.
Oh, that's so kind of you.
Yeah, perfect for Sunday lunches.
It is perfect. And this table's great. We got this on eBay and we had to hire a van. It was so cheap. It's Urquhart, but it was like, which goes for hundreds and hundreds.
Yeah.
We got it so cheap. I think it was like 80 quid, including the chairs.
Oh my goodness.
But we had to hire a van and go to like Buckinghamshire to some incredible like house with an outhouse where it was just sitting there rotting, and we paid cash for it and we brought it home, and it was just perfect for the space. But you're right, like the kitchen is pretty much the whole flat though. It's like the kitchen is the downstairs, which I love.
Yeah, it's the most important room, so that's absolutely fine.
And it means that I'm, you know, if I have friends over, I'm not locked away in some small room.
Yeah,
that's sweaty and stressed.
That's such a horrible feeling. And then they sort of leave and you're like, oh, I didn't really see anyone.
Yeah, now I can just do that in front of them. So it's fine.
But your childhood growing up in Kent, it sounded sort of wonderfully idyllic, a bit like sort of Swallows and Amazons. Like,
oh, it's so funny you should say that, because that was actually one of my dad's favourite books.
Oh, really?
And I think that he really wanted... both my parents had met in living in London, and they really wanted to bring us up somewhere that was kind of magical and more, yeah, more kind of inspiring for us, and somewhere that we could run feral. And I don't know whether it was they wanted us to go off and live these amazing imaginative stories, which we did, or whether they just wanted to get on with their own, which was quite often the case. You know, they just used to open the door and we'd go, and just ramble around and come back at when it was getting dark.
And you went on amazing camping trips and you did it all.
Yeah, we did. We did camping in France and Spain pretty much every year. I absolutely love camping for that reason. I like obsessed with camping.
Really? Even now?
Yeah. Yeah. Still love it. And like Nuts in May. Have you seen that film?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you have to see it. It's a Mike Leigh film. It's a really old one. Alison Steadman, and they go camping, and it just captures like the the geekery of camping and the kind of the politics of the campsite.
God, I need to check that out.
It's hilarious.
So was it your mum that did most of the cooking as you're growing up? Because I did read an interview where you talked about your dad's pheasant dish that didn't go quite
pheasant,
to plan.
Pheasant soup.
Yeah.
Stank the house out with a cloying stench for about a week.
Yeah,
that's so gross. Yeah, no, mum did do most of the cooking and... But dad had his signature dishes, he called them.
What did they consist of?
Some of them were really good. So he'd do things like poached haddock with egg and spinach, which was really nice.
Yeah, that sounds nice.
That was one of his special ones. And then he would dress a crab and he'd spend hours doing that. And then he did a seafood sizzle, which we might come to later.
Okay,
actually.
Yeah. Oh, great.
But he got hold of these pheasants and they were just incredibly high.
Oh, no.
To the point where they were kind of crawling around. And he made this soup and it was just... So it just smelled disgusting, like putrid.
Can you still smell it to this day?
I can still smell this like acrid, sort of sweet, really gross smell. And it just clung to the walls. It brings to mind the smell of like alcohol poisoning.
Oh,
you know, that really clingy smell. And it just went down in history. And we laughed at him so much and we still laugh about it.
Have you eaten pheasant since?
I love pheasant, yeah. If it's not like, you know, putrefying, then I do enjoy pheasant and I think it's got a lovely flavour. A lovely developed flavour, but hopefully not that developed.
No, putrefying.
That has gone too far. Yeah,
one to avoid. That brings us on possibly nicely to the second desert island dish. And that's the first dish that you learned to cook.
One of the first things I learned to cook was a roast dinner because I was helping my mum, assisting on that and, you know, doing all the veg and everything like that. But actually, my mum was fairly, I don't want to say territorial, but she was more of a watch and learn rather than getting me involved.
Yeah. Some people are like that in the kitchen, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like they, you know, they're in charge and...
She definitely knew that she would do it better than we could, so...
But actually, I think learning how to do a Sunday roast, it is probably quite useful to watch, isn't it? Because all about the timings and you probably picked up quite a lot just from watching.
Yeah, definitely. And I was given jobs like doing the gravy, you know, or
that's
peeling the sprouts.
Job.
So prepping food was always a part of the childhood and I loved doing it and I was keen. I was like, Mum, please let me do this. Please let me help. And eventually I got more and more responsibility, you know.
I mean, I feel like the gravy is a big responsibility.
The gravy is a big one. And she always used to, you know, taste it with me and make sure I understood about how to adjust it. And so that was a good one. She always made stock and it was always made properly with proper stock. And there was always I remember she has these, she's still got them in her freezer, Flora tubs.
Oh, so yeah.
Tubs of Flora. And they're always labeled like beef stock, beef gravy. And she's always got like a stash of ongoing. It's like, she's probably got some beef gravy from 20 years ago that's just gone on and on and on.
Yum.
A bit like a sort of really old sourdough starter. So definitely that. And I think the other thing I learned really early on was a spag bol.
Oh, yes.
And that was more because I got really fixated with Jamie Oliver. That sounds really creepy. Not like, you know, when you're a teenager and you get obsessed with things.
Yeah. I mean, he was the naked chef.
He was the naked chef. And I think that piqued my interest because it felt a little bit rude. And then he was just this cool guy. You know, he was doing food in a way that I hadn't seen it done. Like, we always watched Floyd and Rick Stein and we loved them. But Jamie was just this vivacious, you know, much more relatable to a teenager.
Yeah, definitely.
Sliding down the banister and hopping on his scooter and going to Borough Market, and the way he approached food, and he just made it so relaxed, and it made you feel like you could do it yourself. And I remember I got one of his cookbooks for Christmas, and there's a spag bol recipe in there. So it was a combination of that and my mum's recipe, which is also really good. And I kind of combined them and
a killing combination.
Busted that one out a few times. Yeah.
So you sounded very conscientious. You went to Leeds and you read English.
Yes.
And then you didn't waste any time. Like, you got extra jobs sort of for the local paper and you really got stuck in.
Yeah.
Did you know at that point you wanted to be a writer?
No, I was really unsure because I actually wanted to be an actress when I was little.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I really wanted to. And my parents, and I wanted to go to drama school. And I'm going to sound like some big sob story. You know, I'm really lucky that I went to a very good university and got a great degree. But my parents were very keen because neither of them went to uni. They were keen for me to go and they wanted me to get that academic grounding. But I've never been that academic, actually. I'm more creative and my sister's the really academic one. And I did struggle a bit with that initially. I felt like I was, you know, as amazing as it was reading three books a week every week.
Yeah.
At first I was like, oh, I just want to be doing art school or acting. And eventually I got so into my degree and I realized, you know, what a huge kind of privilege it was to be doing something like that. And it was amazing to, and it was when you have more autonomy over what you could read as well. But yeah, it was kind of getting involved with the student paper. I found that really fun, but I didn't really know. I didn't sort of know that I specifically wanted to be a writer. I was tossing up between that and photography.
Okay.
Because I've always taken photos and I love photography. So when I came out of uni, I wasn't sure. I just knew I wanted to do something in media and communication and, you know, portraying sort of content.
Yeah. I think that sort of reminds me that it's so hard to know what you want to do at that age,
so
isn't it?
And when you're 18.
Yeah, and there's so many jobs out there and you don't know what they all consist of. And then there is pressure, sort of really well-intended pressure from parents, but they sort of worry about creative jobs, yeah, don't they? And I wonder whether that's going to change sort of now that the whole job market does seem so different to even what it was 10 years ago.
I mean, it's crazy. When I think about what my job is now, and it's so many different things, I wouldn't have known that these jobs existed.
No.
Like I didn't even know until a few years ago that a food stylist was a job. And I certainly didn't think about food and cooking. And back then it wasn't really, like, home ec at our school was taught so badly by a woman who just clearly didn't enjoy food.
I mean, that's extraordinary,
I know,
isn't it?
And it was just not an option. And yeah, you're right. Trying to know exactly what you're going to be. And if it was either a teacher or a lawyer or a doctor or you know, those were the options.
Yeah.
And as someone really creative, I struggled with that. And because I was a little bit naughty at school, or I was considered naughty, I actually wasn't,
yeah,
you know, that bad. I was just a bit chatty.
Yeah. Very naughty.
And a bit scatterbrained, but, you know, not so naughty. But I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So going down that route was just kind of the way I thought I should go, I guess.
Yeah. And then you had a lucky break when you got a job to cover someone on who was on maternity leave at the Caterer magazine as features editor.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So I got a job straight after uni, pretty much on a local magazine in Leeds, which was similar to Time Out. And
yeah.
It's sadly not going anymore, but it was a great listings magazine and it was a really young team and it was a bit like Press Gang. It was just really fun. And I got some really good general kind of journalism experience there. And then I started writing about food there, actually, because my editor clocked onto the fact that I was obsessed with food.
Oh yeah.
And there was always a trail of crumbs around my desk. And it was like the running joke that in my filing cabinet, I had like a squeezy bottle of mustard and balsamic vinegar and oat cakes and all this food. And so he started giving me restaurant reviews to do, which was when I was like, wow, this is great. I'm writing about something that I'm really actually massively into.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, my friend was working on Caterer and she told me about this job that came up. And I was looking at this point to move to London and try and get a job in the media. And I applied for it and very luckily got it. And that was kind of the beginning of you know, my career as it is now. And they were fantastic team to work with. Caterer is such an institution. So it's a real institution of a weekly magazine for the hospitality trade. Again, a job I never knew existed.
No.
I didn't know there were trade magazines. So it was, you know, it was amazing to find out that this was a magazine.
And yeah,
suddenly being sent into kitchens at a time, you know, it was 2008 and the British food scene was really changing and things were starting to become more informal, but still a lot of it was about fine dining. So I'd never even been to a Michelin starred restaurant. Like, we never ate out. As my mum just cooked at home, or we'd go for, you know, pizza, or
yeah,
we'd go to these rustic restaurants in France when we were camping, but we never went to fancy restaurants. It was way out of the kind of league.
I can just imagine back then that experience must have just, I mean, it must have just sort of blown your mind that this was a job that you could actually get paid to do, and it was sort of everything that you loved. Like,
yeah,
that's just the best scenario, isn't it?
Yeah, it was amazing. And there were other sides to the job as well. Like, there were articles that had to be written about sort of industry stuff, quite dry things about tax or, you know, all of that stuff, because it's important to the people that are reading the magazine. But it was the like interviewing chefs and going to the restaurants and finding out about the food they were doing and seeing that really lit me up and that made me realize, wow, this is actually something I want to look further into and continue with.
Oh, so exciting.
Yeah.
The third desert island dish is the best dish you've ever eaten.
That is just so impossible.
I know, it's a hard question.
I love food so much. And basically, it changes from week to week. You know, it's whatever I'm really feeling like. And then I eat it. I'm just like, this is the best thing ever. And I've also been incredibly lucky to have some really phenomenal meals and experiences with food. So I'm really struggling to specify one, but definitely for me, it's a lot to do with travel. Like I often feel like I'm having the best moment of my life and it's often to do with food when I'm, you know, sitting in a Greek taverna, eating fish that's just been caught and drinking cheap Greek wine with the waves lapping at my feet. Like that is the best moment. But I think on my 30th birthday, my husband took me to Venice and I'd never been.
Oh.
And we went to this wonderful wine bar / restaurant called Enoteca Mascherata on the recommendation of Jackson Boxer from Brunswick House, who told me that I had to go here. And we went there and we shared this huge thing of vongole. Oh. And it was unbelievable with the cloudy Prosecco, Veneto cloudy Prosecco. And we just had this really romantic meal because the whole thing was a surprise going to Venice. And I was turning 30 and I was with Jamie and it was just really special, really, really. And it's like those, for me, it's eating food that's of a place while you're there.
Yeah.
And just tasting, you know, it's either the ingredients of the local area or it's just the kind of culture that comes through in the food. Like they've been cooking this for so long. It's so ingrained in how they live. And it's just an amazing way to taste and experience places through food. I love it.
Definitely. And you're so right. Like those are the kind of occasions that you just can't repeat. Like it's who you're with and it's just the whole thing. Just
yeah.
Amazing.
But there have been so many. I can't.
I think that's a very good choice.
Pinpoint.
You should be happy with that.
Yeah. One. Okay.
The life of a freelance writer. I think it's one of those things that we're sort of hearing a lot about, but there's curiosity as to how it sort of works in the practical sense. So is it a case of constantly coming up with ideas and then pitching them and emailing people? Is that how it works?
It definitely was like that for years and years and years and years. It was a lot of banging on doors and constantly emailing and pestering people and occasionally plucking up the courage to ring and try and speak to someone.
That's really scary.
Yeah. I mean, that's just how it is when you go, you know, when you're freelance. And I had to go freelance because there were just no jobs. It was the recruitment freeze basically all across the media, as far as I could see in 2008. And I just, they just couldn't get in there with any of them. So going freelance just meant, banging on doors, basically. I think now I'm a bit lucky because I've been working for a while on it. So now I'm sort of getting work and it's a bit more reactive, but I still send pitches and I still pitch around for work. And it's definitely not, you know, it's not just rolling in. It's still a case of pitching stuff and having ideas for sure.
Yeah. And do you have any structure to your week? Like, is there anything that's sort of constant or is every week really different?
I do regular recipes for The Guardian's new Saturday magazine, Guardian Feast. And I also do regular monthly recipes for BBC Good Food magazine. So I have to develop a certain amount of recipes every week. So I sort of structure my week around that. So I know I need to spend a few days in the kitchen, you know, developing recipes. And then the rest of the time I'll split it between kind of having meetings, writing, and doing my, you know, doing food styling shoots and other things that come up kind of on the, what am I saying? I don't know, like other things that come up sporadically.
But that sounds like such a nice sort of balance between having regular things that you know you're doing and
it's
then being able to sort of weave all the other interesting things you're doing around that.
Definitely. It's really nice to have a regular thing, and that was tough actually when you completely don't know what your week's gonna bring, when there's nothing in there and you're just having to like wait and see what you can get.
Yeah.
Which is like fishing, you know,
yeah,
you just don't know when it's going to come in. So yeah. It's really good to have a structure now, definitely.
And not really related to that at all, but just because I'm nosy, what do you normally have for breakfast, Rosie?
It depends whether I've had a big meal the night before. If I've been out for a big dinner, I'll tend to have something lighter, like some porridge.
Yeah.
I love porridge, actually. I've been having a lot of porridge and poached rhubarb at the moment.
Oh, yes.
But yeah, so porridge and seasonal fruits. And then when I'm, you know, not feeling quite so much of a food hangover, I'll have, I love sourdough bread. So I'll have toast. I just love toast.
That's funny you say that, because I feel like I'm kind of the opposite. The bigger my meal is the night before,
the hungrier you are the day after.
Yeah, the bigger my breakfast needs to be. So strange.
I probably do that too. Yeah. I'm probably just trying to make myself sound better than I am. I love the sourdough bread and toast and eggs. I'm obsessed with eggs, and especially at the weekend, we always have eggs and toast.
Yes, very good tradition.
Yeah, it's just nothing hits the spot quite like an egg.
No, it's true, Rosie. Wise words from Rosie Burkett.
It's a meal in a shell.
Quit while you're ahead. So the fourth desert island dish is, what is your favorite sandwich?
Ooh. Oh, I love a sandwich. I mean, I really, really love sandwiches, even bad ones. I even quite like, you know, a tuna and cucumber number.
I'm with you.
I just, any sandwich is great. But I think my ultimate favorite one is, and again, it's going to be a variation on this, a bacon sandwich, really good bacon, and then squishy white bread. Ooh, hang on. That's just made me remember chip butties.
Oh,
they also vie for my attention.
Yeah, those are really good.
But I might get to those later on. Okay. Anyway. So a bacon sandwich is bliss on squishy white bread that's been dipped in the bacon fat. So cook the bacon under the grill and let it kind of get a nice pool of fat, and then dip the bread into that. And
oh my God,
a fried egg in there as well.
I mean, yeah.
So that when you bite in, the yolk just explodes in your mouth. And the reason that has such a fantastic resonance with me is because on these camping trips, when we used to go to France as a family, with the dragging the Conway TARDIS, which was the most eccentric caravan/trailer tent.
See.
Everyone was like, oh, do you go on holiday in a caravan? And I could never just be like, yes. I had to be like, no, it's a Conway TARDIS, which was basically, and then like, is that a trailer tent? No, it's not. It's not quite a trailer tent. It was an amazing thing that you basically towed, that pumped up with a crank. You had this like metal thing that you used to insert and crank it up.
Okay.
And then it sort of came up, and these canvas wings came out either end, which were double bunks. So,
wow.
So basically, hence the TARDIS. So you had all the space of a caravan in the middle, and then these extra double beds either side.
Wow,
so you had like, extra space.
It's like a tent from Harry Potter or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was amazing. And my parents kept it for years and years and years, and we holidayed in it every year. And it was this big rigmarole around, like, you know, having to pack it away with precision, having to dry it all out, having to spend days prepping it before we went away. And so we'd set off, and we'd always get the ferry from Dover. And my mum would, we'd be in the queue for the ferry at like 6 a.m. So my mum was probably up at about 4 or 5 in the morning making these egg and bacon sandwiches.
Oh my God, that's so cute.
And she used to wrap them up in tinfoil, and we'd sit in the queue for the ferry, which used to be really long. And my sister and I would just be so excited, just like so excited about the holiday, that we'd sit there with these egg and bacon sandwiches, with listening to our Walkmans and just in absolute sheer heaven.
Oh my God, your mum sounds like the dream.
She was. She really was. I mean, why we couldn't have had a fry up on the ferry like everyone else. I don't know.
No, that would not have been the same. So for anyone who may not be aware, what exactly is a food stylist?
Food stylist is someone who makes the food that you see in books or magazines or adverts or on TV and film look good.
Yeah.
And look like what it's meant to look like, basically.
And it's really important because we eat with our eyes.
Yeah.
And do you have like a little kit bag when you
turn up on set? I do. I have got a kit bag. It's called a Quirkity. It's made of canvas. My mum gave it to me. It's similar to the Conway TARDIS, actually. It's got the similar colour scheme of the canvas and the green.
Do you have everything in there, from tweezers?
Tweezers, yep. I have got a bad habit of leaving things on shoots. Often, you know, thinking that I've got something and then realizing I must have left it on that shoot, which is why I want to label everything. But of course, I haven't got around to doing that.
Yeah, you need a label maker.
I need a label maker. And that's the first hurdle.
Are you one of those stylists that sort of, are you busy varnishing turkeys and using tea bags? And it's more just making it look beautiful without the sort of gimmicks?
Exactly. I had one job where I did end up having to varnish a turkey, and I didn't enjoy it, funnily enough.
The turkey?
I don't think the turkey did either. I basically try, and my motto with the food styling is obviously it needs to look good, but I want it to reflect. I don't do loads of adverts, so it's more editorial stuff, and it's more about making it look how it should look, but bringing out the beauty, why the dish is appealing, why the ingredients are naturally beautiful, kind of trying to bring those to the fore.
Otherwise it can be very demoralizing if you make something and you're sort of looking at it in the book or the magazine thinking, oh
yeah,
it's not what mine looks like. I think it's
It's misleading for people, and I hate that.
I think it's one of those jobs that sounds very glamorous. It's very hard work. Like, you're on your feet a lot.
Yeah, it's really long days, and it's very physical. Like, you know, not the same hours as chefing, but it is in the same way, you are on your feet all day. And it's funny because quite often you'll end up, you know, not really having a proper lunch, and you're so busy. It depends what kind of shoot it is and how many dishes you've got to do, for how many shots, but it's pretty full on. Yeah, very, very hard work, but really fun as well. And what I love about doing it is that you're in a team and you're doing something collaborative.
Yeah, definitely.
Which, when you're writing, you know, I love writing after I've done it.
Yeah, and the satisfaction.
Yeah, the satisfaction. And I do get into it, but I do find the isolation of it quite difficult.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. So I guess that sort of goes back to our earlier point about it being really nice to do a variety of different things.
Yeah, it really is. It's nice to mix it up. But then it equally can be quite hard to get into the right brain as well.
Yeah.
When you're splitting your brain between two completely different disciplines.
Yeah.
It can be tricky sort of readjusting.
The fifth desert island dish is the dish that you eat the most often.
Oh, gosh. Well, I go through phases. Yep. I go through massive phases. And I have been cooking a lot of Sri Lankan food since we got back from our honeymoon, because we went to Sri Lanka on honeymoon. And the food was just unbelievably good. And I fell completely in love with it. And I did loads of cookery classes while I was out there and just made loads of notes and picked it up and have been cooking Sri Lankan food ever since. Well, I say Sri Lankan, obviously it's using British ingredients and it's probably not authentic, but taking what I learned and the way they use coconut and coconut oil and curry leaves and the spices, and they just are masters of cooking with veg. So they use whatever they've got available and it's all fresh and they just make it so delicious. And yeah, so I've been doing a lot of Sri Lankan.
What would be like your go-to Sri Lankan dish that you're making?
Well, I do a really good beetroot one and the dal. So dals are just always a good thing to have on the go. A big pot of dal, dip into it.
Yeah.
Good for breakfast, lunch and dinner.
What's the beetroot one looking like?
So that's, you chop the beetroot into kind of matchsticks, so you julienne it, and then you cook it with curry leaves, mustard seeds, coconut oil, spices, fenugreek, then the roasted Sri Lankan curry powder, which is important. You can make your own. You just make it by toasting a selection of spices and grinding them up.
Yeah.
And the roasting of the spices gives a really deep flavor, which is just amazing. They also use raw curry powder, but I prefer the roasted one.
Yeah.
It's really quick, Sri Lankan curries as well. A lot of people think curries are going to take hours and hours.
Yeah.
But they're actually really quick. So you start with tempering the mustard seeds and the curry leaves in the hot oil. Then you add in sort of onions and garlic and then the beetroot. And the beetroot you sort of toss first with fenugreek, and you add that in with the curry powder as well. And then you just add a bit of the coconut milk and the coconut cream and simmer it until it's soft.
That sounds amazing.
And it's really good.
Yeah.
Really good.
Sounds different as well. I like that.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, when your book, A Lot on Her Plate, came out, it was right at the time when clean eating was booming. And your book, I felt, was like a real antidote to that. And it was a celebration of all things delicious. But I wondered, did you ever feel swept up in the clean eating fad or worried by the timing of things?
I mean, I think at the time I felt like, oh dear, this I brought out a book called A Lot on Her Plate, all about the joy of eating and being greedy and basically obsessed with food and all food indiscriminately. So, you know, at a time when everyone's suddenly worried about, you know, eating anything. So I was at the time, I think, slightly concerned.
Yeah.
And I did feel a bit like, oh gosh, this isn't the best timing for my book.
But actually, it was really good timing because it was so different to that. Like, it, you know, you had such good reviews, and anyone who picked up your book absolutely loved it. It just was an interesting time then.
Yeah, I was actually really pleased that I had done it at that time, and that so many people reacted well to it and loved and embraced the recipes. And, you know, the biggest success in terms of recipes from that book was the salted butterscotch popcorn cheesecake, which is also for sure the most unhealthy recipe in the book too, like the most indulgent. And people really, really love that. And they still, I get these tags on Instagram of people still making it. And
really?
Yeah, lots of people make it as their like birthday cake or their celebration cake for Christmas or Easter. And that's amazing.
Yeah, that's so nice.
So I was really pleased, and I was really pleased to be talking about the joy of food and not being worried about calories or cutting things out. I mean, I understand if you have a medical intolerance or you are concerned about something having an effect on your health and cutting it out for that reason, but I felt like there was a lot of miscommunication around healthy, and I feel like healthy became, and I still to some extent feel like healthy is something that's slightly misunderstood. And the whole diet thing is so complicated. You know, people are constantly being told different things, and there's so much contradictory stuff out there. And I just wanted to kind of say, listen, cooking from scratch is a great place to start. And I'm not selling you a diet. I'm just trying to, you know, help you cook food that's going to bring you joy and nourish you and, you know, make your friends really like you.
Yes, which is the most important thing. I mean, the book is beautiful and everything you said just rings true. Like, I thought was actually really how it worked out was really good timing, because you were providing something so different and sort of helping people get back to what really matters, which is, you know, delicious food. That brings us on really nicely to the sixth desert island dish, and that's your go-to dinner party dish.
Yeah, dinner party dish. Well, it changes all the time because I'm constantly getting different inspirations, or I'm getting obsessed with one. I get very obsessed with things, and my dad was the same. It's monomania. So I'll get like thoroughly obsessed with one thing and just do that, and then I'll move on to the next thing.
God, that's the same as me. I didn't realize there was a name
like
for it.
Well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. So there's not like, it varies. So for a dinner party, I'll probably do something slow cooked, especially at this time of year, because you can sort of let it get on with itself, but it ends up being really kind of rich and delicious, and you feel like a lot of love's gone into it. So I might make a really good ragu, or I might do a slow cooked pork belly, with a, you know, so the skin gets really crispy and the meat's all kind of collapsing and juicy. And then in the summer, I'm probably more likely to do a barbecue or lots of salads and a big piece of roast fish.
Yes.
So it's always something seasonal, basically.
Yeah.
And not fussy. Like, I don't do fussy starters. I always do simple, you know, I'll probably just have some radishes on the table when people come, some sourdough, some butter and salt. I won't tend to do like fiddly little canapés.
No.
You know, things like that. And then I might do a big burrata salad that everyone can just rip into. I love the Italian way of cooking and eating. I love the relaxed, you know, just focusing on things like really good olive oil, really good bread, and picking at things and sharing food. That's my kind of my go-to.
Would that be your kind of top tip for hosting a stress-free dinner party?
Yeah, I'd say do things that are about the ingredients, letting the ingredients sing and putting things together that work, and using, if you want to show someone a bit of love, like, you know, doing an amazing salad with some really beautiful, pristine ingredients and a really good olive oil is a lovely way to do it.
It doesn't have to be complicated.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't have to be complicated at all. And I don't think people, when they go, like when I go around to my friends' houses for dinner, I don't want fiddly little swipes of things. I want like a bowl of something delicious, or, you know, some really, really good pastry, or, you know, something just that makes me happy.
So you're not really disappointed if they don't make a sort of foam or...
No. In fact, I'd be disappointed if they did.
Rosie, I can't believe it, but we're on to the final seventh desert island dish, and it's the last dish you would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island.
Before being cast off, what would I eat? Oh, I know what I'd have. Yeah. Okay. Fish and chips.
Great answer.
Yeah. And this brings me on to the chip butty.
Oh, yes.
The unbridled joy of carb on carb chip butty.
There's nothing better.
It's just... I know it might make me sound pretty basic, but it's just so good. And the smell, still the smell of chips in paper, the smell of hot vinegary chips in paper wafting past my face makes me immediately need to go and eat chips.
There is literally nothing better. So would you go full fish and chips and then have a chip butty on the side?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Every time, my mum lives now by the sea in Kent, and whenever we go there, there is... I'm going to put it out there. I think the best fish and chip shop.
Wow.
Ever.
Okay. Yeah.
And they have really funny opening hours. And you kind of have to check beforehand whether they're going to be open, because they sort of open for a few hours a day and that's it. And because they don't need to be open anymore, because their fish and chips is so good.
And they know it.
They know it. Oh, they know it for sure. The fish and chips is unbelievable. The batter is so light and crispy. The fish is really, really fresh. Incredible big white chunks of fish. And the chips are phenomenal. So we'll get mum to basically warm the plates up and butter the white bread, and then we'll go out and get the fish and chips and bring it back.
You've got it down.
I know. And last time we went, she'd run out of ketchup, so that was a disaster.
You might as well just thrown everything away.
I know. I was like, I can't believe you've let it come to this, mum.
You've let yourself down.
You've got some condiments in your cupboard from 1976, but you haven't got any ketchup. But yeah, fish and chips. And we had that for my wedding meal as well. Yeah, we had a fish and chip van.
Oh my God, that's such a good idea.
Yeah, because I was just like, what am I going to do? People are going to expect something really lavish. And I just, you know, not got the budget for that.
No, that's such a good idea.
Yeah.
Such a good idea.
It was great. I really love fish and chips. So with a side of white bread and butter for the chip butty, so that the hot chips hit the butter and melt it into the bread.
It's key.
It's so good.
God, Rosie, I'm going to have to go and get some fish and chips on the way.
Yeah.
You're allowed to take with you one luxury item. It can be anything you like.
Cyril the Whippet.
Oh, yeah, we've had a few dogs on
the
island.
Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely
Cyril
take Cyril.
Is a great luxury item. Thank you so much for letting us hear your desert island dishes.
Thank you so much for having me.
I told you it would make you hungry. It did, didn't it? Don't forget to head to www.desertislanddishes.co for the recipe I've created inspired by Rosie's choice of desert island dishes. You can also find me on Instagram at madebymargie and Twitter as well, but it's a lot doing both, isn't it? So I have to be honest, it's mainly Instagram. Thanks so much for listening, and I will see you next time. Bye.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.